This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Good morning. Good morning, everyone. Good morning. Welcome to spring. Welcome to Jikoji. And we've been having a session, a week of meditation, an intensive practice time and study time for this last week, and pretty much it's been entirely in the rain, wouldn't you say? And today, Buddha's birthday, the sun is shining, so very good sign. So, today we're going to, as well as this Sunday program, the Sunday program is also the finish of the session, and we're kind of finishing the session, and then following this, we're going to have a nice social lunch, and following that, we're going to have a party. We're celebrating the birth of the Buddha, so we're going to bathe the baby Buddha, symbolically welcoming the Buddha into our lives, into existence, and I think we're going to have some music, and kids are going to sing to us, so we've got a good day ahead. So that's the program. This last week we've been studying the sutra that we just chanted for the service, called the Heart Sutra, and Doug has been our guiding teacher, taking us through the Heart Sutra, and other people. Some of the people from Sesshin have left already, but some are here. So I thought today, we've really been kicking this football around a bit, and I thought today we could see if we could get a goal, see what we can do. Please, everyone who's participated in Sesshin particularly, if you have something to add, please join in as well. So I'd like to thank Doug for guiding us in this, and for all of us participating. What we have tried to approach is this, the teaching of the Heart Sutra, the Prajna Paramita, the wisdom that is beyond conventional or ordinary wisdom, a wisdom or an understanding that is comprehensive and broad and includes everything together. Some people regard the Heart Sutra as it's a Mahayana sutra, and regard the Heart Sutra as something that should be sort of not brought to understanding, a kind of a sacred text, or something that's should be left beyond the sense of words or understanding. And that's really common to the Zen tradition, is the understanding that no words can reach it. No words can approach truth. And in the Zen tradition, there's often subtle ways of teaching that circumvent our ordinary discursive mind and our analytical mind, that try to cut through our discursiveness and our conceptual, what's called conceptual imputation that we bring to things, our descriptions, our labeling, how we make the world, how we fabricate the world. So this sutra, in a sense, cuts through that, or you could say, in cutting through it, it opens it up, and opens it up where, in one sense, it is, it can be understood in a wordless sense, in a non-conceptual sense, nirvikalpa jhana. It can be received that way, and some in the Mahayana tradition, which is where this, in the later development of Buddhism, where this sutra developed, it was an expression of this profound opening that, an inclusiveness that involved not just one thing, but not just one truth, but a kind of comprehensive or broad sense of how things work, how things actually are, how things exist. Sometimes it's called suchness or thusness, yatha bhutam, things as they are. This is this profound teaching invites us to come and see reality as it is, rather than, or even you could say before or beyond how we fabricate it, how we craft it into our little convenient story of what reality is, or what we are, or what things are. So this sutra opens this up. And it's, in a certain sense, it's kind of scary. It's kind of like, whoa, this is too much, you know? It says no to things. It says no to our conventional understandings of things. It says, don't no to our concept of who we are and how the world is and what perception is. But it's not really saying no in the sense of negating. It's saying no in the sense of don't just see it as one thing, or don't just see it as a separate thing. Don't just see reality as this narrow, conventional way, but the sutra is inviting us to see it in a broader sense, in a more, I would say, a more complete sense. Sometimes it says, in the sutra it says, form, or substantiality, or body. Form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. Or in the sutra we use the term, instead of emptiness, we use the term boundlessness. Or sometimes it's translated as voidness. The Chinese character is ku, which means spaciousness or unformulatedness. Same character also means sky, just vastness. So substantiality is non-substantiality. Non-substantiality is substantiality. So it sets up these paradigms, and they appear to us to be opposites, actually. And conventionally, they are opposites. But what the sutra is inviting us to do is to see them not as opposites and not as contradictions, but as complements. These things work together. These things support one another. The Well, here's a ordinary, conventional, maybe a metaphor or an example of it. Everybody knows that music or speaking is dependent on silence, right? Yeah. And they're mutually dependent. And they support one another, and they complement one another. And they need one another. They in order for music or sound to be sound, it needs non-sound. And conventionally, non-sound needs sound to be non-sound. You can get that, right? Yeah. So the sutra goes through our whole experience, form, sensations, perceptions, our mental formations, or our conceptualization of the world, impulses. It's got various terms for samskara, and even consciousness itself, the whole sense of consciousness. So that's what we've been kicking around. That's that football we've been kicking and squeezing and seeing what happens. And I don't know where we are with it. We're still on the playing field here. I think we'll always be on the playing field. I like this quote by the founder of this temple, Koban Chino Roshi. This was in his book, or a version of this was in his book. He said, and he talks in this very poetic way, he said, "It is very important to experience the complete negation of yourself, which brings you to the other side of nothing. You go to the other side of nothing, and you are held by the hand of the Absolute. You see yourself as the Absolute, so you have no more insistence of a self, of yourself. You can not even speak of self as no self upon resting in this Absolute. So you flip to the other side of nothing, where you discover that everyone, everything is waiting for you. Before this, although everything is already helping you, you are a closed system." So what this sutra is encouraging us to do is understand that we are closed systems. We are, in our conventional understanding of ourselves and the world, we are closed systems. We are containers, and we have our methodology and systems for maintaining ourselves. Most of it is, have you noticed? People that meditate notice this a lot. I notice it a lot. Most of that maintaining is through a kind of commentary. Sometimes we call it internal dialogue. We talk to ourselves. We maintain the world through this constant reinforcement of identity, of separation, of self, through our internal dialogue. And what's very interesting about a long period of meditation, like a sesshin, is that we, that tendency, that routine, or that habit that we have of maintaining ourselves, starts to dissolve a little bit, and we get a sense of space. We get a sense of release from that conventional fabrication of identity, of self, of separateness. So, what do we do with this understanding that self and no self are complementary, are supportive of one another? That what do we do with the sense that everything that is not you, everything that is, say, outside the border of your body, is, you could say, conspiring to support you. Everything that is not you makes you. Without the not you, you would not be you. And so, what is everything that's not you? And we can understand this when we are with a partner, with a family, with a tribe, with a community, that we're supported and we're helped by our friends, those who love us, those who care for us, those who believe in us. We can understand that and that level. But the sutra is actually asking us for this to be even broader, to actually see that not just they, those particular people that are supporting you or are close to you, are those that not you is making you, but all of what's not you is making you. Conventionally, walking around, it's hard to keep this in mind. But what the sutra is inviting us to do is to keep this in mind, that we are actually totally involved with everything. The first teaching of the Buddha, before he talked about before he tried to help, when he was enlightened, he was like happy. He was thoroughly happy, and he noticed in his state of happiness that others were not happy. So he, like a physician, he went to address that with his teaching, and so he taught that suffering exists, unhappiness exists, it has a cause, it's optional, there is release from it, and that there's a path for release called the Eightfold Path. So that was his first teaching. But before that, he said, wonderful, everything is here with me. He taught his first insight was called it got defined in Sanskrit, it's called pratityasamutpada, or codependent arising. It means that because of this, there's that. Because of not this, there's not that. Because of everything is involved with everything else. So there's what Doug and other teachers and some of us talked about causation, that every event and every experience has cause, and it's dependent on cause, and it itself is a cause for other events. So pratitya talks about the understanding of pratitya samapada, or codependent arising, is causation, that things are related or involved with one another through cause and effect. We can understand that. That's pretty clear, right? There's another understanding of pratitut samapada, which is whole and part. Everything is, all the wholes or the unifying factors of society are dependent upon their parts. And the parts themselves are, you could say, dependent or defined by what they make a whole of. And the third thing about pratitut samapada is what's called conceptual imputation. In other words, something exists in our sense, in our relative human sense, working with our intelligence through conceptual imputations. So I am a person by the conceptual imputation of being a person, plus, you know, the actual physical sense of being a person. Those two are dependent on one another. The conceptual imputation is dependent on the actual, what you could call the substantiality or the actual event, and vice versa, from our point of view. So that's a handful, I know, but that's the story so far. That's the football we've been kicking around, and with a few bruises, right? The question is, how do we bring this into our life? We can hold the sutra as esoteric and unique and unknowable, and that's true because it's a very broad teaching. But we can also invite the sutra to inform our daily life. I have an example from my history. In a previous lifetime, I was a teacher of visual arts, so I would teach. I taught figure drawing and figure painting, and so there'd be a model on the stand there, and I would attempt to get students to learn how to see in an aesthetic sense. And in order to see in an aesthetic sense, you have to actually drop off what we conventionally call, I called it image identification. But I think there's another term called object recognition. In other words, like, this is a lectern, because because conventionally it's been labeled as a lectern, or a piece of wood, or whatever. We have image identification of this as an object, as a thing. And we go through the world, most of the time we go through the world, and we very fast and almost unconsciously, most of the time unconsciously, we label or we make image identification, and we identify things according to what they are. And we say that's a hogan, and that's a dug, and that's a floor. And once we've labeled it, we're kind of, we don't actually see it anymore. We've finished our relationship with it in a certain sense because we've labeled it, because we've identified it. So in the experience of like teaching students to see, there's various devices to stop this image identification, like a table. Normally we'd look at a table and we'd think it was it's got a square, flat surface. And but if you were drawing that table from a certain angle of view, It wouldn't be a square. It would be some other shape, some oblique shape, according to your perspective and your point of view. So in order for the student to see that, they actually have to drop off the sense of image identification, which carries a model in their head of this is a table and it's got a square top. They have to kind of unlearn that or release that to actually see. And there's other devices like in drawing a figure. Sometimes I would ask students to look at the negative spaces. Instead of looking at the figure, you look at the space around the figure and you study the contour or you study the shape of the negative shape rather than the shape of the figure. And these are ways to drop off that sense of image identification that so that you could just see. You could just see shape or just see color or just see a contour. Some people say, oh, I can never draw. But actually, if you can learn to see, you can draw. If you have enough fine motor skills to sign your name, anyone can render. Anyone can draw if they can learn how to see. So this is kind of an example of our of the way that we identify and limit our world, and in so doing, we miss this interrelationship. And the practice of meditation, in a sense, is helping us to drop off that that narrow view, that limited view. Sometimes in the teachers will say, just follow your breath, just be with your breath. That might be a meditation instruction, or just be present. You notice the word just, shikan, it's in Japanese, shikan, just do this one thing. So this invitation or experience of meditation to just do this one thing is a way for us to release this conventional world of our making, which is always describing, which is always commentating upon our world, and also kind of creating a world by just doing the one thing. The early monks, by the way, they, in order to kind of specialize in this way, they left the householder's life, which was a more complex, busy life, and practiced meditation. And they simplified their life as much as possible, like we do when we meditate. We look at the wall, we keep things quiet, we make things very simple. The structure, there's a simple structure when we're sitting. We make things very, very simple and direct so that we can just do one thing. We can just be with one thing. And it's even said that the monks, they deliberately simplified their external life. So they just had they were really specialized, so they just received offerings so they could eat. And they just devoted themselves to meditation. And they just had a bowl, and they just had a simple robe that they wore, and they practiced either independently or in groups, doing this meditation practice that the Buddha recommended and that we do. We do the same thing. They kept things as simple as possible, as direct as possible, as elemental as possible. And you could say they deliberately became poor. They became impoverished of the embellishment of life. They became really radically pure, poor, so that they just did this one thing. There's even kind of a funny story where it's funny to me. I don't know if it's funny to anyone else. It's very funny to me that the teacher, Reb Anderson, told this story one time that the monks that were experienced, the older monks, when they went out to beg, they received more food than the newer monks, and the supposition was that their bowls were emptier, the same size bowls. Their bowls were emptier than the younger monks. In other words, they conveyed a sense of that there was nothing there, and so the people that gave them food saw that, oh, I want you to keep living. I'm going to give you some food, and your bowl looks really empty. I'm going to put more food in it. So our practice of meditation is this deliberately doing one thing, being very simple and direct and straightforward, and coming to meet ourselves without the embellishment of our glorious world with its internet and its stories and its media and our internal dialogue, just being here. Sometimes after people meditate for a while, they'll come outside and they'll look at a rock, and they'll not only see the rock, but they'll see the shadow of the rock. They'll see the rock in the environment of the rock together. And it's nothing special, but it's a kind of example of how the Prajnaparamita, this right in the midst of form, there's no form. Right in the midst of rock, there's, with the rock, there's non-rockness together, is experienced. I've had an experience where I walk out of the Zendo and I really enjoy the space between two trees. Have you ever had that experience? You see the trees, but actually what you're seeing is the space in between the two trees. And it's really great. You can see the trees and the space between the two trees kind of supporting one another, being together. How are we doing? 20 after. Would anyone like to join in? Yeah, Michael.
Very good analogy. I just realized something when you were talking about the opposite being within, and everything's when you get to that space where you're on the other shore. That means, and I was trying to, earlier I talked about trying to make this practical, Heart Sutra practical in my life. I've heard a lot of things today. So my actions, if I'm not alone, then my actions have consequences beyond me. I mean, even on the smallest things, you know? And I had never thought of that before, you know? It just dawned on me that, oh, then that means my behavior has consequences beyond what I can think of. So I really should pay more attention, you know?
And also before that, what you're experiencing right now, everything else sort of came into that experience. It wasn't just you having that experience, you know. Everything else that supported you and brought you into being is involved in that experience of what are my consequences?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I kind of get that. I mean, it's kind of like an aha thing that just got. Yeah. That was cool. And I mean, Hogan said earlier, he's not alone. I was like, well, what do you mean? And now I get it.
Yeah, it's the same.
I get it. Yeah. I think I get it. I get it a little bit anyway. It makes sense more. You know, it's just like, wow, okay. Thank you.
My interpretation of the Buddha's understanding about codependent arisings was that effects and causes arose together. That an effect came into being at the same moment that his first cause came into being. And that's why he said, when he was enlightened, that all beings are enlightened for all time.
I've never thought of that. That's interesting. That's it. Yeah, I like that though.
And I also thought my understanding of causality was that it operates both in the conceptual world and in the non-conceptual. And that's why something like effects and causes kind of arise together.
That's right. That's one of the... There's these sort of three understandings of codependent arising, and one is causal, conceptual imputation. There is conceptual imputation of,
yes,
and that sure. That is it's part of the mutual independence, the mutual dependence of those two things, yeah. To see them as both arising together, though, it's interesting. I never thought of that, but I always sort of being in a time stream, you know, you think of it more as kind of linear time, you know. Because of this, then that happens, because of that, and it has that effect.
Part of the conceptual world. Yeah. So if you're operating outside of the conceptual world, then it doesn't need to be part, or it's sort of...
can be timeless, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Huh. Pratitya Samuppada, or codependent arising, is sometimes really hard to get our head around because we negotiate the world mostly by ignoring it. And we're very good at ignoring it. And actually, I would say that our evolutionary legacy necessitates us having to ignore it. We need to know that say, Vincent is my enemy and he's going to attack me. So I need to identify Vincent so I can survive, you know? I mean, you're not my enemy. You're my friend, actually. But I'm just using that as an example. But I think that's part of our legacy. But I think you might say our evolutionary imperative, our growth, which is I wouldn't say it's physical at this point. It's more spiritual, mental, psychological. Is to kind of release that sort of narrow image identification or that separation that we have and to see that both things exist together and have that broad view. I would call it like, I hate to use the word spiritual, but that's a spiritual, that's what we're doing. We're growing. That's how we're growing. That's why we're here meditating and so on, you know. We're evolving in this particular way. Did you have a question? Yeah.
Yes. maybe you answered it with the previous question, but I'll ask it anyway because maybe there's something else there. So let me start by saying that we recognize that that words are conceptions and that they are not the thing, not the actual thing, and I guess we might have noticed it, like whenever we look for a meaning of the word, it's always another word, and the meaning of that word is always another word, and then it goes on and then creates this web, and when we think of in terms of words, it brings up other words, and that's how we kind of keep jumping on all these different things. And so we recognize or understand that there is this internal dialogue and there is this reality that the dialogue is part of, but it's not the whole, and there is this reality separate from the dialogue. And having that understanding and having that understanding versus experiencing that understanding and really seeing that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like this, there's still some way to get there. So
mm-hmm.
What is it that holds us from just understanding and experiencing or knowing it or seeing it?
Do you feel held by the conceptualization? The conceptualization or the understanding or the insight that you might have about that actually could be a gate, could be a door in. So in other words, even though it begins as a concept or an idea or an understanding, it can develop into a what you might call a full experience. The early teachings of the Buddha, there were four jhanas, or four meditative states, jhana is sometimes translated as knowledge or knowing, jhana, the Sanskrit, but it also means a meditative state. So the first one is vikalpa jhana, which is the knowledge or the understanding that comes with discursiveness. It's part of our equipment, you know, to talk and to reason. I mean, that's what human beings do. It's part of our knowledge. So the first jhana, or the first meditative state is with discursiveness. That's okay. The second meditative state is called nirvikalpa jhana. Non-discursive awareness. You're still aware, but you don't have that descriptiveness going on. You don't have the commentator, the critic, the voice of that's describing or labeling. It's just pure experience. Before the Buddha left his people that he was, there's five friends that he was meditating with, and he was doing these ascetic practices. He remembered he had a time in his childhood when he was in a state of nirvikalpa jhana. He was underneath a tree and he was watching his father doing a ceremonial plowing, and he was present, he was at ease, but he was not thinking. He was just there. That's nirvikalpa jhana. And we experience that in meditation. We all do. I mean, a little bit or a lot. That's part of the meditation experience. The third jhana is the same thing, nirvikalpa jhana, experienced with joy and gladness and a sense of completeness. And the fourth jhana, which is the jhana, it's ascribed to be the jhana or the state that the Buddha woke up in, had his enlightenment experience, was the upeksha jhana, the jhana of equanimity, where you're in a state of nirvikalpa jhana, but everything is equal and balanced and supporting one another, and there. That's the state where Buddha woke up in. Those are the four jhanas. So don't discount vikalpa jhana of discursiveness. It's what we do. Our minds secrete thoughts. We're made to think. We're reasoning beings. And our reason, even according to Aristotle, we are the highest good is virtuous action in accord with reason. Or we could say, some people don't like the word reason, in accord with wisdom, in accord with true knowledge. So that's the, according to Aristotle, which he was really a good guy, I recommend him. Yeah. Study Aristotle if you can. He's almost, he's almost like a Buddhist, you know, he's a proto-Buddhist or something. It's virtuous action of virtue or excellence, which is excellent of its kind, like a knife is excellent in the fact that it's sharp, and a person is excellent in the sense that they know, that they can come to knowledge. Aristotle might use the word reason, we might use the word prajna or wisdom, but we're made to know. We ate the apple. We need to know. So that's vikalpa jhana. So don't discount that. Come to knowledge. And then in coming to knowledge, you can see what happens, you know? There's other jhanas that are waiting for you.
Quick thing here, analogy, metaphor of teaching students how to draw and to see the space around. I'm wondering if, we sit and face the wall, with nothing to do, and we're just there, that there's all this spaciousness around us, and maybe it's that spaciousness around us that then helps to liberate us and give us a new perspective on the self that's so intertwined with everything. And then instead it's just we see the space around us more, and that gives us a little liberation.
Like between you and me.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.